Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does food help us gain insight into cultures very different from the ones we grew up with? Journalist Anya Szadlo grew up in working-class Chicago with Polish, Irish, Scottish, and Greek roots, and especially fond memories of her grandmother's stuffed grape leaves. As an adult, she moved to New York to work as a journalist, married a Lebanon-born American Muslim, then spent her honeymoon just outside the Green Zone in Baghdad, where the couple had moved to cover the war in Iraq. During that time, and later when she went to live in Beirut, Szadlo learned to relish how the rituals of cooking and eating offered both a fragile common ground for people with different views and also a comforting taste of normalcy, even as bombs drop and bullets fly. Anya Szadlo has worked as a special correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor in Baghdad and the New Republic in Beirut. Her new book is called Day of Honey, a memoir of food, love, and war. Anya, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
So food might not seem to some people like an obvious way to frame a story about war, but to you it feels like it's always a very political topic. Can you talk about that?
I think my first introduction to food, obviously, as for most people, was from my mom and my grandmother and from family. And both my mom and my grandmother were big feminists. They believed that women's work should be taken very seriously, that cooking, cleaning, taking care of children and old people, that these were important things and things that were worthy not just of being taken seriously and paid well for, but also of being studied academically and you know, in all sorts of ways. And so I've always had this respect for the work that we sometimes consider every day or, you know, even drudgery. I was raised to think of that stuff as very important.
You and your husband were good friends before you fell in love, and it surprised some of your friends that you'd end up with somebody who turned out to be a really picky eater.
Yes, I think that shocked people more than anything. I think that's probably the biggest cultural difference between Muhammad and me, who I should point out, you know, is born of a Muslim family and born a Muslim, but we're both pretty secular. Mm-hmm. So he's Muslim, like I'm Catholic. But that's actually something we share more in common. And then the food, it's just we're complete opposites.
So you'll try anything.
I will try anything once, and sometimes even twice. He really doesn't like to eat stuff that he hasn't already eaten, which, as you might imagine, kind of limits his options.
So he was born in Lebanon, but eventually sent to relatives in the United States for his own safety. Will you talk about the kind of violence at home that convinced his parents that that was a necessary sacrifice to make?
Sure. And this is something that was very, very common among children and during this era in Lebanon. I have a lot of friends from Lebanon who have sort of a similar family history. What happened with the Lebanese Civil War, and I write in the book, you know, I was not by any means a Lebanon expert or a Middle East expert when I met Muhammad. And so when I first met him, I would sort of talk around this topic of the Lebanese Civil War. I would say, oh, wow, it must have been pretty awful, and then quickly change the topic because I didn't really know what it was. Mm-hmm. And until I had read several books about it and studied it for quite some time, I realized that it's actually more than one war. Because we often refer to civil wars as one war when there are many wars. Darfur is another good example from the current time. Wars evolve, they change, they may die down for a while. And this happened a lot in Lebanon. What would happen was one war would take place, maybe 75 to 76. People would think that it was over. They would start sort of cautiously going back to their neighborhoods. And then, you know, a new militia would spring up, a new conflict, new sources of funding for the various militias, and the neighborhood would be no longer safe. People would have to move around. So after a while, people started getting really just exhausted from all of this. And a lot of people were realizing, when you see this kind of street-to-street fighting, that it's really a terrible environment for bringing kids up in.
Yeah.
And so luckily, my husband's family were able to send him with a brother who lived in New York City, in Queens, to be exact. And he was only 10 years old, so it was very disruptive for him to, you know, be the age of 10 suddenly, you know, separated from his mom and dad. But it was also, you know, it was a transformative event for him. And I have a lot of friends who grew up that way.
There's a really poignant anecdote in the book about, you know, he was in this place where he was safe, but the aunt, I guess, or sister-in-law that was in charge of helping to take care of him was not happy to be in the U.S. And there's a poignant story about her when she would get little treats, she would give them to her own daughter and not to your husband, which seems maybe like a small thing, but gosh, when you're that age, it's a big deal.
I think it is a small thing, and I think, look, you know, it's she probably didn't even mean anything by it,
yeah.
But for a kid, this kind of stuff makes a big impression. And I think it was something that I really identified with because I had moved around a lot as a child a little later, you know, starting when I was 13, and, you know, kids really dwell on this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And what I noticed and what I realized again and again, I saw happening in Beirut and Baghdad, the time that I spent there, that for a child, a meal or a piece of cake, just something very simple, an apple, can take on this significance because it symbolizes a life that you've lost.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we all react that way to food sometimes.
Yeah, you know, it was funny reading the book. I have four kids who are, you know, in school age. And even when there is plenty of food, you know, they'll sort of fight over things or get very excited when somebody brings home cupcakes or something. And we live in a completely stable environment where there's enough for everyone. It must be incredibly difficult for parents, and I would think mothers in particular, when there's not enough to go around or when they can't guarantee that they'll have enough next week.
There's a story in the book, a very, very short chapter, about a mother in Baghdad. And it was just this heartbreaking thing that I actually wrote about for the Houston Chronicle. It's the first story that I wrote from Baghdad. Was about this mother who had been very, very spooked, as had many parents in Iraq, by this terrible bombing that happened right at the beginning of Ramadan. And as it happened, it was the week before her daughter's birthday. And so she kept her daughter out of school for, I think it was a week and a half. And then she finally, her daughter was going crazy, and she was going crazy, but it was this terrible choice that she had to make. You know, do I let my daughter go to school and risk the fact that there might be a bombing on the very road that she might be taking to school? Or do I say, no, listen, you know, education comes first. We can't live like this, and send her to school. It was a horrible choice to have to make. And so she decided that she was going to throw this extra special birthday party for her daughter, and she was going to get her this fabulous cake. And the more she talked about the cake, the more I realized that really it wasn't about, you know, having a fancy cake. It was about the cake had become the symbol to her, mm-hmm. of normal life and of her ability to go to school and send her daughter to school and all of these things that they had lost. And I think that it's natural. I think we all do that with foods. I think we all have a food that to us symbolizes something much more than just that food.
And one thing that, you know, people may not make this direct connection, we hear a lot about marketplaces being targeted in times of war, particularly mm-hmm. in that part of the world. Mm-hmm. Even shopping for food can be a dangerous thing. This is this day-to-day thing we all have to do, even when there's a war going on, and it might be the most dangerous thing people go out and do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's one of the first places that gets targeted, marketplaces, restaurants, hotels, cafes. I think there's a couple of reasons for this. I think that terrorists like to target these places because nothing sows fear and terror like this attack on something that you have to do every day.
Mm-hmm.
It's really an attack on normal life. And I should add that in a place like Baghdad where electricity is very irregular, you have to go shopping every day because you can't just keep stuff in the freezer and in the refrigerator. So all of these forces combine to make it, you know, absolutely essential that you go to the market, but also very dangerous. I think there's another thing about markets, and I'm a real market nut. I love markets. And one of the reasons I love markets is because they're often in a city that might be somewhat segregated or somewhat, you know, balkanized. The market is usually the place where everybody goes. It's usually a place that's free of divisions of, or at least relatively free of divisions of sect or gender or, you know, religion, ethnicity, these kinds of things. And I think that's one of the things that makes them so wonderful. I think that's another reason why terrorists like to target them.
You wrote a charming piece, I think it appeared for the first time in the New York Times 3 or 4 years ago, about your first Thanksgiving when you were living in Baghdad and what that was like for you.
Yes. Wow, that's amazing that you found that. It was a fascinating time. When I first got to Baghdad in the fall of 2003, people still had a lot of hope. A lot of Iraqis were really, really still very happy that Saddam Hussein was gone. And they were really hopeful that there was going to be some sort of democracy. And this Thanksgiving for me seemed to crystallize this moment when there was still some sense that people might have something to be grateful for or happy about. And it was unfortunately also a time when that hope was starting to become very fragile.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ended up shopping for turkey in the markets or shopping for a roasting pan in the markets of Baghdad with a friend of mine. It was just very funny to sort of try to explain to people. It was right after the end of Ramadan, and I was sort of trying to explain in my very limited Arabic at that time, you know, that you guys roast a whole sheep or a lamb or a goat at the end of Ramadan. Well, you know, we have a similar thing, but we roast a whole turkey. And they just thought that was the funniest thing they'd ever heard. Turkey, interestingly enough, is an American bird, as we know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's spread all over the world, and everywhere in the Middle East and South Asia and in the sort of, you know, arc of countries in Western Asia, it's referred to by different names. Some people call it Indian chicken. Some people call it Ethiopian chicken. And some people call it other names. In Baghdad, they call it elishish. And for some reason, whenever you say the word elishish, people just crack up. They don't know why.
It's a funny-sounding word in English, so maybe it sounds funny there as well.
I think it is. It's just, you know, one really charming thing that people do in Iraq is they give these goofy nicknames to sort of certain foodstuffs.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like they're like little people or personalities. And elishish is definitely one of those.
Yeah, it was funny because I guess people always refer to it as a he somehow, like you have to cook him in the oven. Is that common for all things that you'd roast, or was that specific to the elishish?
You know, I think it was just because it was elishish. I don't know. That would be a good question for one of my Arab linguist friends. Because I noticed that people did sometimes speak about certain foods and, you know, as a he or a she.
So throughout the Middle East, the cuisine of Iraq, I gather, has about the same reputation that, say, British cuisine has throughout Europe, which is to say, not mm-hmm. respected. What did you find there? Is the food very different in Iraq than in neighboring countries?
It's a really, really interesting story. And I'm going to go back into my own personal history to answer that question. I'm from Chicago, but I was raised in southern Indiana, and we had some pretty amazing, very, very southern-influenced cuisine there that's, you know, native to southern Indiana. And when I moved, people always ask me, did I have culture shock when I moved to the Middle East? And I always tell them, hey, I had culture shock when I moved to New York City. And one of the things that always made me laugh was that people in New York, Midwestern food has this terrible reputation in the Eastern Seaboard, and particularly in New York. And I would hear over and over again people denouncing Midwestern cuisine, often people originally from the Midwest, mm-hmm. my dad. And they would talk about how bland it was and how it was just really terrible, and it was all, you know, Wonder Bread and potato chip casseroles and things like that.
Frito pie and pickled eggs, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, there was some of that. But, you know, we also had some pretty amazing stuff. We had fried catfish. We had hush puppies. There's this very particularly southern Indiana dish, persimmon pudding. It's very, very old and very spicy and very rich and has a lot of history. And so whenever they would say that, I would just say, huh, okay. I guess they don't know. and so when I got to Iraq and I heard people talking like this about Iraqi food, oh, didn't you know it's the worst food in the Middle East and they have no cuisine, I would hear this phrase over and over again, they have no cuisine. And I would think, like, oh, it just sounds like a lot like people talking about the Midwest. And I know that that's wrong, so it's got to be wrong here too. And also, you know, knowing that Iraq is ancient Mesopotamia, it's the Fertile Crescent, it's where agriculture as we know it began. Like, this is got to be wrong. So I decided to set out and find the good Iraqi food.
You stop there because we need to take a quick break. Anya Szadlo is my guest. She worked as a special correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor in Baghdad and the New Republic in Beirut. Her new book is called Day of Honey, a memoir of food, love, and war. You can join us on the phone by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Anya Szadlo. Her new book is called Day of Honey, a memoir of food, love, and war. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Anya, you set out to, what, to know the cuisine of Iraq, to defend it?
To find the good stuff. what I found was that there's this fascinating dichotomy between home cooking and the stuff that you would get in restaurants and hotels and public places, mm-hmm. And even street food. And most of the people who thought that Iraqi food was not good, and obviously, you know, none of these people were Iraqis, most of the people who thought it was no good had not had a home-cooked meal. And so they weren't experiencing the home cooking of Iraq.
Yeah, what a huge difference that must make.
Mm-hmm. I think especially in a country where there's a very particular restaurant and hotel cuisine that's not, they don't have a history of, you know, of restaurants that make a specialty of home cooking. Mm-hmm. A lot of countries don't. A lot of countries don't consider home cooking to be something that you'd serve in a restaurant. And vice versa, I guess.
So when you and your husband were living in Baghdad, you were just outside the green zone. Mm-hmm. And you were able to witness really the decline in the way that Iraqis looked at the U.S. military presence and Americans in general over the years that you were there. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was heartbreaking. It was heartbreaking because we sort of saw it go from this era when we could walk around. I mean, when I first got to Baghdad, I would flat out tell people that I was American. Not everybody, obviously. Seeing the attitude toward America deteriorate to the point where I couldn't do that, or where people would feel vulnerable talking to a foreigner, mm-hmm. even people who were friendly. It was heartbreaking, and especially, you know, we had made some friends by the time we'd been there for a while, and just seeing the decline in their expectations was something that was incredibly heartbreaking. Mm. There was a gentleman that I became very close to who was an Iraqi Christian, and he was so happy when I first met him. He was really optimistic. He really he loved George Bush, and seeing his expectations decline over this period was utterly heartbreaking, to the point where he was just desperate to leave because he felt that he was in so much danger.
There's this great expression that comes up several times in the book, which is, there is bread and salt between us. Can you talk about what that means?
Sure. It's an ancient tradition, and it goes back to the Old Testament. It goes back to the... there's something called the Salt Covenant, and this is this idea that the Israelites made this Salt Covenant with God, that he would protect them. And it goes back even before that, I believe. The ancient Assyrians called a friend a man of my salt. Mm-hmm. And this was this idea that salt not only was it something precious, but it's also something that preserves. And so a bond of salt was considered a sacred bond, and people would actually seal contracts with salt. They would actually, on signing a contract, you know, have like a little bit of salt and take it out and use that. And so that was translated into this custom that people still do it in the Middle East and also in Russia, also in Eastern Europe, of breaking bread and sharing salt. It goes to this idea that food can bring people together. It can be a symbolic bond between people, which I think it can be. I think it can also drive people apart, but that's another question.
Well, it does. You know, over and over, we're reminded that this can be a wonderful bond, and it's also a fragile one. People can eat together today and really be quite literally at each other's throats tomorrow.
Exactly. And so that's why I think that we can't read too much into this custom of breaking bread. I think civil wars are a really good example of people who can eat together one day and kill each other the next. At the same time, I do think that that bond is sacred, and I think that that's why civil wars, we have an especial fascination with civil wars. They seem to us utterly horrifying in a way because I think there's this taboo, this very ingrained taboo that all human beings have, that once you eat with somebody that you shouldn't do them any harm.
Talk about meeting your, at the time, future in-laws for the first time.
Wow. God, it seems like so long ago. I was very nervous because I'd been studying Arabic, but really only, you know, just for a month or two. Mm-hmm. And they don't speak any English at all. A little bit of French. Muhammad's father spoke a little bit of French, but his mother didn't speak any. And so I knew that I would have to speak with them only in Arabic, and I was horrendously nervous. Just imagine meeting your boyfriend's parents. And then the added difficulty of not really speaking their language very well, and then the added difficulty of religion and, you know, cultural differences, that it's a completely different country with its own completely different set of customs and mores. I was unbelievably nervous. And thankfully, both of his parents were really, really wonderful and welcoming. And even though, you know, the language thing was a bit difficult, they really went to great pains to make me feel welcome. And one of the ways that they did that was by his mother making this, you know, wonderful feast. And when we ran out of things to say, we just sort of sat down and ate.
And we should say that you write that Muhammad does not like functioning as a translator when it can be avoided at all.
Yes, and I've made him do it so much over the years. No, he's not crazy about it. He does it very well, that's the funny thing, but it makes him very nervous. And I think particularly, look, I think he was nervous too in context like this. You know, I think it's also stressful to take your girlfriend to your parents.
Sure.
So.
And then at the time you got there and they had accepted you, they said, great, we'll put together a wedding for you post-haste. Is that how it happened?
I didn't know any of this until later, by the way. So another reason that I think Muhammad felt particularly stressed out, like not only does he have the stress of translating, but also he has to sort of filter and edit out, you know, stuff I'm not going to tell my girlfriend that I haven't been dating that long, that my mom wants us to get married right now. She basically, once she decided I was okay, which she did in about, you know, 5-10 minutes, she decided that we were just going to get married right then and there. Which, you know, since Lebanon has, you know, religious marriages, would have been eminently doable. and she actually, she was going to get up and make a phone call. And thankfully, Muhammad's quick thinking saved the day. We didn't get married until months later.
Yeah, he said your mom would be offended if she wasn't involved.
Yeah, and that was a very wise move on his part. It was very, he's very good at sort of taking people's values and saying, oh, well, you know, this would, you know, violate our values. In other words, you know, telling there was an uncle who got involved and he wanted to, you know, make sure the marriage happened too. And suddenly the whole family was involved in getting us married right away. And he was like, well, wait a minute, but we haven't consulted with her family. And so that sort of took them aback because, you know, they immediately figured, well, you know, I wouldn't want someone to just marry one of my daughters without asking me. So.
Well, it seems like a great skill for a journalist, you know, who has to go into situations that are potentially really difficult and keep everybody calm enough to collect the story and go.
Yeah. Yeah, he's very good at that. He's very, very good at that. And I think it's a very stressful thing to do because you're constantly sort of, you know, moving back and forth between one set of cultural assumptions and another, mm-hmm. and having to explain, you know, one person's cultural assumptions to another person and vice versa. And I've seen him do that on many occasions. It's hard work.
Now, you mentioned earlier, you alluded to the fact that you moved around a lot after the age of 13. Your mom was in a marriage. It did not work out, and so you guys were moving around a lot after that. Do you think that picking up and starting over so many times helped you to sort of understand people who've been displaced by conflict?
I think it gave us something to, like a sort of common ground, mm-hmm. and something to relate to. And I think it gave me an understanding of what they might be going through at that moment. I don't know if I can claim to understand the experience of, say, my Iraqi and Lebanese friends, because I think they have the additional burden of not being able to go back, and you know, having the place that they came from be utterly, utterly changed beyond recognition in some cases. But yeah, I do think it definitely allowed me to relate to people, and it made me sort of think of particular things as important. For example, I really identified with this little girl that I was talking about earlier in Baghdad who couldn't go to school because I had a couple of occasions where I couldn't go to school, and I really hated it. So to me, that's what made that seem like a really important story.
And, you know, the food connection is interesting, too. You write about being in high school, and you had a girlfriend who seemed to have everything. She lived in a fancy house, and her parents were married. But she came to your house and was really stunned by the fact that your mom took the time to make you a hot meal.
And it, her being stunned utterly stunned me, because I just assumed that everyone's mom did that every day. I didn't realize that my mother was unique in doing that. I just figured, wow, if my mom is making, you know, lamb casserole with rice and parsley and toasted nuts, then, you know, her mom must be making bœuf bourguignon or something. The idea that, you know, that they might just kind of forage in the pantry for a bag of potato chips and maybe order pizza, I didn't know. I had no idea.
So the first time, I guess you guys were still dating right after 9/11, when Mohammed was sent to Pakistan to report for Newsday, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, how did that affect the relationship, the distance and the inability to communicate at any moment that you might want to?
You know, I always tell people, particularly if they have relatives overseas in the military or, you know, any kind of dangerous situation, having been in a war zone and having had relatives in a war zone or loved ones in a war zone, I would actually rather be in the war zone.
You'd be, rather be there yourself, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that to be noble. I mean, I think there's a certain degree of selfishness to it, but it is unbelievably stressful to have a loved one experiencing danger and not being able to do anything about it or even know where they are, what they're going through. It was one of the most stressful things I've ever experienced. And added to the fact, you know, I was also in New York, and I worked pretty close to Ground Zero, and so that was stressful in its own way. It was definitely, when Mohammed and I got to the point where we had actually been separated for longer than we'd spent together, it was a bit strange. I think it made us realize how much we must really love each other. Like, hey, wow, we're still together, and we spent more time apart than we actually have in the same city.
And the honeymoon phase of your marriage was quite literally spent in Baghdad.
We didn't really plan it that way. And again, it was mostly because I realized since we were moving to, we decided to get married and move to the Middle East because he was the bureau chief for Newsday, the newspaper. And I realized that if I was sitting in Beirut and he was in Baghdad, that I would just be going absolutely insane with worry. And in Beirut, I didn't know anybody. And I didn't have a job, and it would have been, I figured in many ways, I figured it would be easier for me just to go to Baghdad with him.
Did that help you learn the language faster? Because you then started freelancing from Baghdad, and I would imagine you didn't always have a translator with you.
No, it actually slowed me down, interestingly enough. It's a very good question. The Lebanese dialect and the Iraqi dialect are very, very different. And so I had studied mostly with Lebanese and Palestinian teachers, which have many different words and different accents and stuff like that. And then I would go to Baghdad and I would try to use those words and expressions that I had learned, and people wouldn't know them. And then I would come back to Beirut with these Iraqi things that I had picked up and they wouldn't know them. And I would never know if I had just gotten something wrong or if it was just a different dialect. So that actually slowed me down considerably.
So I guess it would be like Texas English and Glasgow English or something. Is that accurate?
Or maybe, no. I mean, accent-wise, yeah, I think that's an apt comparison. But so many words are different that it would be, I mean, I guess you could draw the comparison maybe of Mexican Spanish and Puerto Rican Spanish. Uh-huh. But I think it's even more drastic than that. I think there's even more different words than that. It was vocabulary wise. It was definitely this language barrier between Arabic and Arabic that I ran into.
Anya Szadló is my guest. Her new book is called Day of Honey, a memoir of food, love, and war. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. And on the phone now we have Faria in Dallas. Hi, Faria.
Hi. How are you?
Very
glad
well.
Glad to
thanks.
Listen to your show as always.
Thank you.
I wondered if the writer could talk more about how, you know, in Arabic families, and I've seen this, I'm from Pakistan myself, and my mom would cook, you know, for 2-3 hours straight, and it's almost like a ritual. You know, I've known other Arabic families, and they cook for a lengthy period of time with all the ingredients, and I wondered if the writer could talk about, like, you know, how that's an act of love, or, you know, explain what she thinks about being in that environment and watching someone cook for so many hours.
Yeah, thanks so much for your call.
She was asking, I'm not sure I heard exactly everything, but she said something about talking about that it's an act of love to spend these many hours.
She was talking about her her family's Pakistani, and her mom would cook for 2 or 3 hours at a time, and it was a ritual as much as anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And it's also an act of love. It's something that you're doing for your family and giving to your family, but it's also can also be something you're sort of doing for yourself too. For me, I found it was often very therapeutic, and I think also for my mother-in-law, it definitely gave her a sense of self-worth. She's working with her hands, she's accomplishing something, you know, it was her job, and she liked to feel proud of it, and like she was doing something worthwhile.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. It's almost like taking control when you don't have control of everything else. You can control how the meat comes out or how the vegetables come out.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Very, very well put. And it's also something that can really be a stress release. You know, if you're having a hard time, and you know, maybe there's stuff going on outside, chopping carrots can be very therapeutic.
I guess especially if you've been chopping carrots the same way for 30 years, it doesn't feel so scary.
Yeah, it doesn't feel scary, and it's something that's reassuring to you. Like you said, it's something you can control. And it's something also that it can be an occasion for people to bond. Mm-hmm. And getting back to that idea that it's an act of love, if you can do it with somebody else, it can really bring you together, because it's a chance to work together on something that has a, you know, a concrete output, something you can both use and something you can both be proud of.
Anya Szadlo is my guest. She worked as a special correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor in Baghdad and the New Republic in Beirut. Her new book is called Day of Honey, a memoir of food, love, and war. Join the conversation now by sending email to think@kera.org or call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Anya Szadlo. Her new book is called Day of Honey, a memoir of food, love, and war. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I want to talk about one story you tell in the book. This is when you are living once again in Beirut and fighting has broken out, and it's scary for civilians and journalists alike. And you, I gather, helped an NPR correspondent sort of get from her hotel to safety at your apartment. The question I have for you is, what made you think it was safer for you to go out than for her to go out alone or to remain where she was?
That's a very good question. I think in situations like that, you sometimes don't really necessarily think straight.
Mm-hmm.
I think in this case, it might have been marginally safer for me to go get her, because I was, I knew the neighborhood really well, having lived there for a while. And also people in the neighborhood knew me. And also she had been trapped in the basement of the hotel where she was staying. And I had been watching everything from my apartment balcony.
Literally out the window, this was all going on.
The windows and the balcony just both had a bird's eye view of this street fighting. So I knew where the snipers were. Basically. I had a couple of friends had instant messaged me. I had a friend who lived in the building next door, and I had found out through Facebook and instant messaging that there were snipers on top of her building. And so having this kind of information, you know, I don't know if it would have necessarily helped, but it's helpful in a situation like that. But again, I don't know if I was even thinking straight at that time. In this chapter, I also talk about how I felt safer in the kitchen, where it, you know, there was a huge window and it was probably not safe at all.
Yeah, you're making pasta. Well, once you get everybody back, you decide, let's cook a meal.
Again, this is just something I think in this case, probably that I was just doing for myself to make myself feel better. Mm-hmm. And it probably wasn't the most practical thing to be doing at the time.
Well, I want to ask you too. I mean, obviously your husband had a more experience with this sort of thing than you had had, but you'd been living in these places that were dangerous. But were there times when he felt like he had to sort of keep you from, you know, sort of rescue you from yourself and from your innocence about what might happen to you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. He's got a very good radar. Having grown up in Beirut during the Lebanese Civil War, he had an excellent sense of, hey, maybe we shouldn't go down that street today. Mm-hmm. Just this sort of internal radar that people develop in a situation like that, and that I just don't have. And I'm also, I tend to be a bit reckless anyway in situations like that, even when I know that it's dangerous. So there were many, many occasions when he would say, hey, you know, let's not go out today, or let's not talk to these guys over there.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Scott in Dallas. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Yeah, I was going to say, I also cooked a Thanksgiving dinner maybe that same year you did. It was in Algeria. They weren't used to sort of the buffet style of eating. You know, they put a plate of food at the table and everybody'd pull out of it. So the buffet, they just ate like kings and really enjoyed that. But I was wondering if you had read Voltaire's essay on tolerance, where he tries to get the Jews and the Christians and the Muslims all together to eat a meal of hen and rice, and he kind of skewers the Christians and the Jews, but of course they were, you know, and defends the Muslims, but that was I think kind of necessary considering the time. Mm-hmm. But I thought a really powerful and great essay. It's actually harder to find now than it was a few years ago. I don't know if you've come across that.
No, absolutely not. You said this is Voltaire?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Wow, thank you so much. I'm writing it down, and I am going to get it right now.
Perhaps
it's hard to find. He's got two or three essays, you know, on tolerance, but this one's going to say, you know, let us eat a meal of hen and rice.
Well,
it's neat. You know, he says, as long as Ezekiel doesn't mix his meal with ours and, you know, Balaam's ass doesn't take in his head to bray, you know.
Right.
Just a lot of funny stuff. But I found also, at least in Algeria, that most of the people, if you were American, would, you know, give you things for free. A few people would want to exploit you, assuming you were rich. But it was just hard to tell. And
Yeah, that's true. I found that in Syria, people tended to want to just give me stuff for free as a sign, like, hey, you know, our countries might be enemies, but we don't consider you an enemy. And you'd constantly be sort of having to evaluate, like, God, can this person really afford to give me something for free? And that happened to me a lot in Iraq as well.
It seems, does that happen more in other countries than it happens here? Because you hear always stories about people, you know, if individual Americans travel, very often they'll come back and say, I was told over and over, we don't agree with your government, but you're welcome in our home, you're welcome in our store. And in this country, it seems like we hear a lot of stories about people, innocent people being treated rather rudely by Americans who have, who perceive political conflicts between the two governments.
You know, it's really, really interesting because we hear those stories, and I think as Americans, we sort of, especially if we're sort of conscious and aware of how our country appears to others, we tend to think, oh, my God, this is so much a shame. But I met a lot of people in Lebanon, for example, who actually felt quite at home in America and who had lived there for years and who actually had. You know, every once in a while you meet a couple of jerks, but who had met many wonderful people who went out of their way to make them feel welcome. I think it's kind of the same anywhere.
Yeah. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. Let's speak next with Lisa in Dallas. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Sure.
This is a topic that's very close to my heart. I'm also married to a Lebanese American. His family is all in the United States now, but we lived a lot overseas. We lived in Africa and the Middle East, and I have always found I also lived in Morocco. And my comment is just about having respect for local cuisine wherever you are, because I find that I've always been humbled by going into someone's house of very limited means, mm-hmm. but being treated to a feast that I probably could not have prepared. And the converse to that is myself trying to prepare what I thought was just a fantastic feast, and people would come in and look at the food and just kind of shake their head or politely refuse because it was something they couldn't eat or they had never had and they weren't really interested in. And an example of that I will give you is we think, you know, for example, I tried to make a New England fish chowder. I was living in Yemen. It was easy to find fish. It was easy to find some of the ingredients, but not all. I went to great lengths to make what I thought was an ultimate New England fish chowder. I presented it to some people who were actually originally from Lebanon, but had did not looked at it kind of in disgust and were afraid to eat it. And then what I found out is because they never mix their fish with any dairy products.
Yeah.
So the idea of them of having pieces of fish floating mm-hmm. in heavy cream was just not something they were interested in.
It's absolutely true. This is an ancient belief that goes back to the Middle Ages and actually even beyond, that if you and I have heard people tell me this in Lebanon, that if you mix fish and yogurt, you will die. It's fascinatingly enough, it goes back to the medieval idea of the four humors. Huh. Fish were believed to be, the four humors was this idea that every element, and particularly in food, is made up of four opposing natures. There's wet, dry, hot, and cold. Mm-hmm. And something that is considered to be very wet and cold, like a fish, should never be mixed with something that's also wet and cold, like yogurt or dairy, because it'll just be too wet and cold. And that when you have something that's wet and cold in nature, that you have to mix it with something that's hot and dry.
Talk about the interesting links you found between the Greek food you'd grown up with and what you ate in Lebanon.
It was incredibly similar. I was really shocked by how similar it was. And I have been doing a lot of research into Greek food since then and have since found out that Greek food actually changed a lot since my great-grandparents moved from the Peloponnese to the United States. Mm-hmm. And that actually the food that they prepared 100 years ago or over 100 years ago in Greece was actually more similar to Middle Eastern food than what we think of as Greek food today, which involves a lot of bechamel sauce and ground meat and pasta and stuff like that. But that, you know, a 19th century Peloponnesian peasant would never have recognized.
I loved reading your account of rolling the grape leaves and the idea that you can tell who's rolled which one because everybody's hands have a sort of different shape that they make them into. I have a neighbor and who's also a dear friend, and she makes these, and she always invites people over when she's going to do it. And you write about the fact that it's typically a sort of a shared chore.
It's like a quilting bee.
Uh-huh.
It's a quilting bee or a bridge game or a floating craps game or something like that. It's really a social occasion. It's a social food. And I have tried to make them on my own, and let me tell you, it is not fun. You definitely, if you don't have friends over, you're going to have to listen to, you know, several hours of NPR to pass the time because it's going to take a really, really long time, and it's much more fun to do it with other people.
It's like making tamales.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly.
So talk about your decision to leave Lebanon.
You know, it's funny. It's it was this very strange thing where the last chapter of the book I talk about how when Muhammad was ready to leave, I was not really quite ready to leave.
You were really falling in love with the place and the people.
In a way. Falling in love in a way, but also I think there was something I wanted to understand more of what I did about it. Mm-hmm. And I think part of that was also understanding his very complicated relationship with it. I think it was necessary for me also to understand not only why he loves it, but also why part of him also hates it
mm-hmm.
or is made very sad by it. And I think it was necessary for me to understand that. I think it's easy when you move to a foreign country to sort of initially have this honeymoon period where everything is great and you fall in love with it. And it was important to me to see the dark side of it as well and to see why so many of my friends who lived there were unhappy or had to leave or were constantly stressed out and depressed. I didn't want to have this relationship with the place where I was, you know, somewhat like a tourist, like mm-hmm. only seeing the good stuff.
And he said this amazing thing to you, which is that the war never ends. There's always another conflict, and you have to choose to end it yourself, which in his case meant getting up and going away to a place where you don't have to live with war every day.
Yeah. Yeah. And to be honest, if Muhammad hadn't said that to me, I don't know if it would have occurred to me.
No, it's a fascinating thought, and it makes perfect sense. But I agree, it doesn't necessarily spring to mind if you haven't dealt with that yourself.
You know, I think we all sometimes we can have our own wars, and I'm not about to compare something in my personal life or something like that with the Civil War. But I do think that we all sort of have these. We all have these sort of Rubicons, these special, battles that we fight in life. And sometimes it's really an essential skill to know when to say, hey, enough. I'm not going to fight this one because I'm not going to win it because no one's ever going to win it.
So you live in New York now, is that right?
Uh-huh. We go back to Lebanon for about 3 or 4 months every year.
Oh, okay. So you get plenty of exposure. I was going to ask if there's anything, you know, living in this food capital of certainly the United States, if not the world, if there are ingredients that you still can't find until you go overseas and bring things back with you.
You know, it was funny. I was talking to somebody in Wisconsin the other day, and I was saying everywhere in America and probably everywhere in the world, you're going to find an Arabic grocery store. And you might not even know that it's there,
mm-hmm.
but the migration, and particularly the Lebanese diaspora, which began in the late 19th century and continued for quite some time, a lot of people, very, very similar to Greeks, a lot of people came over and opened restaurants and grocery stores. And so anywhere in America, you're probably going to find a Lebanese grocery store, a Palestinian or a Yemeni or something of that nature. I haven't had much trouble finding a lot of this stuff. And a lot of it you can find on the internet as well. I go to usually, various websites there's a very good Lebanese brand, El Wadi, W-A-D-I. You can usually order their products online. I haven't had much problem, amazingly enough. Now, that being said, there's certain things that you always want somebody to bring you. Because you might be able to find a version of it, but you want your version that you're used to.
The exact thing that calls to mind those flavors, yeah.
Exactly. Maybe I'm getting to be a little bit like Muhammad and that I have to have the exact same spice mix and it has to taste exactly the same.
Journalist Anna Szadlow has worked as a special correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor in Baghdad and the New Republic in Beirut. Her new book is called Day of Honey, a memoir of food, love, and war. Anya, it's been a great hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.